Tashin often brings up feelings of gratitude, alternating with feelings of non-gratitude. But it's quite something to think of everything that makes this possible. The innumerable labors. The main ones of which are you all sitting here. There's many more outside, all around, throughout the whole world, but to make this unusual and unique thing called Sesshin happen, so much support, seen and unseen. So thank you all for especially the group who's here now, being through most of Sesshin and really keeping the steady practice going, keeping all the forms going. It's so beautiful, huh? Often I'm struck by the beauty of our the setup of our outer retreat, keeping this ancient way that has so much, like, what is it about it? The ancestors discovered, you know, various forms to support our practice, and the ones that seem to be beneficial have lasted. And I think Sesshin is like its own teacher. It's maybe like, so we can give, there can be talks like this, and we can study things to learn about how to practice in different ways, but just Sesshin itself, that great being called Sesshin, is like the great teacher, right? And sometimes she's totally wrathful, bares her fangs and spreads her fire, and sometimes she's totally beneficent, pouring her water of compassion drip by drip out her vase. And, you know, one period can be experienced by some people as wrathful and some as peaceful. And with, you know, whatever's happening and whatever teachings are happening, whatever is going on, we have the basic practice. We might forget sometimes, but I think we don't forget it for long. Those of us who've been practicing some, I think actually Chuck summed it up quite well the other day when you said, I find, like, if I'm having a hard time, I see if I'm holding on to any stories. And let go of my stories, try to let go of my stories. I think that's like the bottom line. That's like, if we get confused, that is the basic teaching of Buddha. One way to put the teaching of Buddha, I think, is like, there's suffering. What is the origin of suffering? Story, holding stories. And so if we, you know, this is like our always our fallback practice. If we're sitting in Sesshin and not having a good time, okay, that kind of means, I've heard that means that there's a story being held on to. I'm not holding any stories, I'm just not having a good time. We can look deeper. And even, you know, because the stories can get quite subtle. Sometimes they're really obvious, but usually they're not so obvious. If they were really obvious, we're not holding them for that long, right? We can catch it and, okay. It's the, for keep suffering, the story is quite subtle, and especially on physical pain, right? Because it might be like, well, I don't really like have a problem with like the, you know, the situation or the what's going on in my life at large, but just like sitting with this uncomfortability for so long, you could say, and I just don't like it. You see, there's quite a subtle story there. The suffering of physical pain is actually a story. Yeah, quite a subtle story. But you beg to differ.
I don't beg to differ. It's such a strong experience with me that my stories get worse. Like if I'm exhausted and tired and, you know, then those old stories really seem like they
start out.
If I'm feeling kind of fresh and vigorous, they don't seem to have such a hold on
me. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's why Sashin is such a strict teacher, because she says, well, I could make it really comfortable for you all, and then you could just bask in the glow of the spring breeze. But actually, I'm going to make it like a little bit uncomfortable, maybe more than a little bit, because you're going to put your body on a seat for day after day. We can guarantee that it will not be comfortable. And so that's part of the thing, that's the challenge from that teacher called Sashin, is like, yeah, I think it's very true what you're saying. It triggers our other stories. The uncomfortable, the tired is another kind of uncomfortable of like, if I could just wake up, then we have more stories and grumpy. And so it's a kind of like all like this, you know, it's Sheen, you could say, is like designed to like, we might say it's designed to lessen the stories, simplify it so we have less stories. It has some of that quality. And has some quality of increase your stories in the way that you just mentioned. Yeah, so then that's our special challenge on being overwhelmed by the stories that are coming out of these raw, physical, basic animal needs like rest and movement. But, you know, I would just still propose that like you could still look at this as like there's subtle stories involved there, and then they trigger other mood stories, and so on. So still, that it's the same practice always, right? Of like, there's some idea I'm holding, grasping. When we talk about grasping, it's basically always idea. But it's closely connected, because there's a way, which maybe we've all experienced occasionally, where like the body can be like super painful, the mind can even be drowsy. I think that's even harder for me than the physical pain. But we're still, there can be like this open resting in the middle of all that when there's just not holding or resisting the same thing, any of it. It's just like, this is what's happening, dying into it. Right? And that's, I think, part of the design of Sashin is it says, you know, we're offering you the chance to, like, let go in these very difficult conditions. And what an amazing training over and over again, Sashin after Sashin. You know, and it's not just for its own sake, right? And we know, we go back into our life and face difficult situations. They will continue to arise, and this is training the mind to relax and let go in very difficult situation. Sometimes you might, you know, I think especially newer to practice, we can look, everybody's sitting so still, like, am I the only one in pain here? Let me tell you, no, you're not. We don't know about the degrees for different people. My first sashin, I remember actually at City of 10,000 Buddhas, this community, And I was really up for doing a retreat, and it started out great. Wow, all this zazen, I'm getting really, like, my mind has never been so clear and settled. And then just more and more painful day after day. And I kept thinking, something's wrong here. This isn't supposed to be happening. I mean, it's probably uncomfortable, but not like this. I mean, this is like too much. And I went to one of the monks there, and I was like, excuse me, can I just ask you, is this supposed to be happening? That the body feels like on fire? And yeah, that's normal. I think I maybe said something like, how long will it take, will this keep going on? I think I said it like that. Does this keep happening if you keep practicing like this? How long does it last? And he said, you never know. He didn't say it'll last forever, necessarily. Yes?
I was just going to appreciate this invitation, ongoing invitation to experiment.
Oh, yeah.
Because for me personally, it really helped. Like, there's always these points in Sesshin, several or many, where I go, no, the Buddhas and ancestors were wrong. This is stupid. This is not the way to, you know, calm the mind. This might have been different experiences, I'm sure, for others, but everything pretty much that I tried that was, okay, I'm going to try bringing a settled mind, you know, to walking, it didn't help.
Something.
I mean, it was like, wow,
nothing works.
At least for me, at this point, this is the way, and this is the place to be able to... have some, and to do this job of studying myself. So
you say, when it seems like nothing's working, that's the place?
Well, I'm just saying that it was a teaching for me that these forms indeed, even though, because I would always ask, there's got to be a way to do this. I mean, where does the pain come in?
Uh-huh.
Why does
the
posture in particular, you know, trying different ways, I really kind of realized or felt in my body how much this posture supports a calm mind.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, there's a reason, even, you know, it may be uncomfortable, and the reason isn't to make me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's that this is a support, this is a posture, and this is a stillness supports.
Yeah, no just random coincidence that this posture for 2,500 years, it really, it's a great discovery from ancient experimenters that discovered this posture. And the pain, it offers us that chance to really get to see how with this posture and relaxation and breathing and all of these things, there are ways to settle more at ease with when there's a lot of physical pain. The thought came up for me like if there was this kind of pain and I was maybe, I don't know, like trapped in some situation, like riding on a crowded bus where I was like squeezed upside down, you know, and some like balled up posture or something and lots of loud music playing or whatever, like a situation where you're in that pain but you can't really settle as much, that would be like total torture. And sometimes we might feel like that's what it is because we can't find that place. But to have the pain with these tools, like the posture and the breath and the silence and, non-distraction, not much distraction from the lots of stuff happening, so we can really just pay attention, then it's a completely different possibility.
You know, I wonder if the Indians or the old ones were more comfortable sitting than we in the West, because of a lot of things that are about the way we hold ourselves and the way we...
Could be. Mm-hmm. Could be that, you know.
Feeling about it.
And especially, as, you know, cross-legged kind of sitting on without chairs is still, like, in India, you see a lot of, like, a lot of the, I think of, like, the vegetable and fruit vendors and little, like, stalls. They're, like, little carts with bicycle wheels, and they sit, they pull them out in the daytime, and that's, like, their store. And they're often, they could put a chair next to it, but they often sit on the platform on top all day, just sitting cross-legged or some posture like that.
And maybe other cultures in that part would just squat.
Uh-huh.
If that's how they, you know, yeah, they don't sit, they don't even just plump down.
Yeah. Or in Japan, seiza is a common posture for just everyday life. So I get really used to just kneeling on your heels. So, but I think all these things are like, I think that, like you say, get used to it. We could say, well, maybe their bodies are actually a different shape.
Yeah.
Maybe possible, you know, shorter in Japan. But I find, you know, as someone who, like, I don't have any furniture in my room, you know, so, like, all day, and I'm sitting almost all day at the, I say cross-legged at the computer, and because I sit that way all the time, it's, like, pretty comfortable for me. It took a long time, you know. At first it wasn't so. So there is a kind of like a training of, you know, getting used to something too. Also, I wanted to mention that like several people said to me in Dogisan how much they appreciated the zero tolerance practice, which I was, you know, I hesitated a little bit to talk about it, because I thought it's, you know, in the context of relaxation and kindness and ease and a lighthearted playfulness, zero tolerance. And yeah, several people say, wow, I was really working with that and became really present more than ever. So I, you know, yes. Zero
enough.
Was zero tolerance for conceptual thought?
Yeah, like where you say, like, there was a word you said yesterday.
Another one was if a discursive thought starts to arise, immediately release it.
Release.
I mean, they release. Yeah. Release it. Like it's actually flying away on its own. It's just that we usually actually hold it instead of release it. So here it comes. Yeah, immediately release. And that this can be helpful, and, you know, for myself, actually it's quite challenging. I give myself that instruction, and the habitual mind is, it finds that very hard to. Especially if, like, maybe I mentioned this before, I feel like if I'm a little bit dull, if I'm not really awake, like slightly sleepy, but not sleepy enough, you know, present enough to really just be here and relax and, you know, pretty present and kind of, you know, can keep an object somewhat, but just that little edge of tiredness or dullness, then it becomes almost impossible, I find, to do that immediate release. Mine has to be really alert. That's what I've noticed. I like to drink matcha during the rests. Come back and really. And you know, eyes open. Some people have been experimenting with even keeping the eyes wide open, which our tradition, we generally say just a little open down. But there are practices where you can, like, look straight ahead, wide open. And sometimes, you know, there's more input coming in now, but actually it's very, very vivid and alert. So, Since we have this chance, we're talking about this turning the light around, one last talk. Whether or not you're working with this, and again, Sesshin is a teacher. It'll, you know, let it help you practice however you need to. But is it okay with you if I offer one more version of this Vipassana kind of practice? And in this style, turning the light around, as I mentioned, I'm seeing as a Vipassana practice, very close to Shamatha in the Zen style. Shamatha is calm abiding, Vipassana is special insight, they mean. And that the union from the old Indian teachings, the union of Shamatha and Vipassana is like the condition for realization. When these two come together, realization of reality and opening to the peaceful, free mind. So sometimes it's like in the Sandinamochana Sutra, which is an excellent source for Shamatha and Vipassana. It talked about Shamatha is a more non-conceptual awareness and Vipassana is a more conceptual, using conceptual objects instead of non-conceptual objects. And I feel like the Zen style, because it so emphasizes direct experience and non-conceptuality, I feel like there's these subtle teachings of unifying Shamatha and Vipassana that are basically non-conceptual. Or if they're conceptual, it's very slight, just enough to turn the mind, to direct the mind in a new way. So that whole collection of turning the light around teachings, I hear that as when you're already settled in a calm, abiding body and mind, then a subtle practice that's a little bit additional to that, a little extra step of looking back at the source of awareness. So this is a... And in Zen, you know, the style in Zen is don't say very much, or as you say it, mask it in all kinds of weird poetic phrases and confounding, mind-boggling strangeness. That's our family style. That's Dogen, that's and his predecessors. So this is a kind of like maybe going a little bit outside our family style to like explain a little more. I think this very simple thing, this is going to be an explanation that's fleshing it out a little bit, but it's still talking about this very simple, non-conceptual practice by Ken MacLeod in this book called Wake Up to Your Life. And Ken MacLeod's a student of Kalu Rinpoche, one of the great Tibetan yogis who spent most of his life in retreat and came to the West in his later years and taught these practices. This is a picture of Kalu Rinpoche and Tenshin Roshi at Green Gulch Farm in probably in the early 70s. I think he died in maybe the 70s. Yeah. A young Reb, probably in his 20s, 30s maybe. So that kind of interchange was going on at Green Gulch, sounds like, in those days. He was one of the really great ones, Kalu Rinpoche. And Ken MacLeod, who I met at Green Gulch, actually, he came 10 years ago or something to give a talk. And he's an interesting character. He's like, at least when he was there, he was like almost like in this Vipassana kind of like mode. Like, I don't know if he's like that all day long, but like we're sitting at dinner and he's like really present and just like, so what's happening for you now? He couldn't have just like a kind of like a mundane conversation.
Like,
yeah, maybe he didn't ask that, but it was kind of like, I had this feeling talking with him just in a very informal setting that he was really like looking into like questioning what's happening all the time. And maybe because he was at a practice center. But he's a lay person, and he lives in LA, last I heard, and he has like, he decided he didn't want to set up like a practice center. He wanted to just have this very like, it's like that's too complicated. He just has like an office and people can come talk to him about practice. And he just, maybe he's sort of like in retreat himself. But he wrote some books. And I think he's got a gift for trying to really put this in his own words. And outside of lots of, you know, Buddhist terminology and so on. So for me, I find this refreshing. See what you think. So first he's saying you practice calm abiding and using the breath as an object, or he also talks about this wide field of awareness, very similar to all the senses open, vigilantly releasing conceptual thought, becoming, and he talks about the wider field is more vibrant and you're starting to get closer to this non-separation of mind and object than with a smaller object, narrower object like the breath. So it's, that's part of the advantage of this wider field. So you're, that's shamatha. You start with shamatha. And a cardinal, and then we're going to talk, he's going to talk about vipassana, insight. A cardinal rule for insight practice is to work from a base of stable, clear attention, like from shamatha. When you look at the nature of experience or the nature of mind, which is what insight is about, you will fall into confusion again and again. Thoughts and feelings will erupt in you, or you will fall into thick, dull states of mind. You will feel as if you can't meditate at all. So this is why really be, you know, keep coming back to this clear, non-conceptual, unconfused shamatha, resting, abiding. Because you can't do insight if your mind is either full of thoughts or thick and dull. Therefore, insight is not a thinking, you know, a lot of conceptual wheels turning. You might as well try to see your reflection in a pond ruffled by a strong wind or a pond filled with mud. So reestablish stable, clear attention by letting go and returning attention to the breath. Or letting go of this looking practice of vipassana and return to the breath, then go back to the looking. So the insight practices given here use questions about the nature of mind, such as, what is mind? And in Zen we have all these examples of like, who is this? Who is facing me? I think a really classical one that's very much in accord with this, that we maybe don't think of as a vipassana practice, is when Hweka comes to Bodhidharma and says, my mind is not at ease. I'm suffering. Please pacify my mind. Bring me your mind and I'll pacify it for you. Bodhidharma says, and Hweka says, maybe he actually sits down in shamatha for like a long time, looking back at the source. Okay, I'm trying to find my mind to bring it to you. And when I look for it, I can't find it. And Bodhidharma says, I've pacified it for you. So this is very like pithy Zen little saying, but there it is. It's like looking back for the source of mind, I can't find it. That is the pacification of the mind that's not at peace. Really, I pacified it for you by these instructions, but really you pacified it for yourself by looking back and not finding it. The not finding is pacification.
Isn't there a step also, another one, you're looking back, you're not finding it, and something else has to happen for you to be at peace? is you could look back and not find it and be disturbed by that.
If you're doing it in this way, and here's some more details I'll present here, but if it's this way where you're in a non-conceptual way, you're already stably settled in shamatha, and you look back in this way, you kind of know from the beginning, because we talk about this, that the source of mind is empty. You're not going to find some, and it has no reference point, so you're not going to find it. So if you look back and you don't find it, maybe it could be disturbing. If you keep trying to look and thinking you're going to find something, that would be like Sogni Rinpoche was saying, you're looking too hard, or you're going and you go past it. So with this very gentle looking, kind of knowing in advance you're not going to find it, but actually experiencing that that source is empty, you know, it's hard to talk about this in great detail because it's all beyond words, but that it's inherently not disturbing. It's inherent. It is peaceful. If it goes in this way, I mean, what would be an example where it wouldn't be peaceful?
If you wouldn't accept it, if you weren't saying, I'm fine with infinity.
Yeah. So, maybe a way that it couldn't be is around like fear we talked about on previous days.
Control.
Yeah, or like.
This is the big one, you know, that I have no way to grasp this can be a very disturbing.
Yeah.
Number.
Yeah. Yeah. So again,
so
I think
somebody's ready to go. Okay.
Yeah. So maybe that would be a way that it could be disturbing in the way of like, I actually can't stand to let go of all control and knowing what's happening, knowing who I am.
That is what religion is all about. I mean, religion that establishes answers.
Oh, it's control.
Looking back and saying, oh, I see what it is. You know, instead of emptiness. Because it's so disturbing.
Yeah, yeah. So even teachings like we have, like all these teachings over and over, the source of mind is empty and still and bright and luminous. We can hear that. That's actually not that disturbing. But to experience it directly may be actually kind of disturbing. But that's why I think if we're have some experience in practice and we're grounded in the shamatha that's already pretty close to that. It's pretty close to that ungrounded groundlessness. But it's very stable and clear and bright and fresh. Then with that, then that last bit of like dropping off, you know, the doer and the done and any kind of sense of duality, that maybe it's not that shocking. Right? It's not that disturbing, actually. And also we hear all these teachings of like, this is almost like the goal. This is kind of like what we're aiming. So it could sound, again, I think it can sound, yeah, I'd love to realize emptiness directly. But that is said in the teachings that as we approach it experientially, it's like, oh, but that's not what I thought it was a nice, comfortable idea of emptiness. This is like beyond my ideas of anything. So it could be disturbing like that, but if we're grounded in shamatha, here's some more description. He talks about this actually some, I think. So these questions are simple questions like what is mind, or the source of mind, or like the insight that triggers, maybe we could say. You may come up with logical, this is kind of a, so what we're talking about, you may come up with logical or philosophical answers, but for the purpose of developing insight, such answers are worse than useless. So you say, well, then why do we talk all this stuff?
I just be sitting.
Yeah.
Oh, we do that too.
Yeah, we do that too. But in some ways, I would say, and you know, in his tradition, they have a lot of philosophical talk too, right? I would say it's to like, start getting used to where we're looking. It's getting an idea. It's like a finger pointing at the moon. Because if we don't, if we just say, we'll just sit and see what happens, this might not dawn on us. I think it really might not. We might not discover. It's a kind of specific thing. So we don't hear that the source of mind is empty and a non-dual but clear awareness. Then we don't have much to go on. The experiment is so wide. This laboratory is so huge that it's like we might be discovering lots of other things along the way, which could be very valuable, but we might not get this one. So you could say maybe that's one way of talking about why we have all these teachings about it. But at the time of actually cultivating Vipassana, then forget about it all. It's in here. It's in the storehouse. And now we forget all about this. For the purposes of developing insight, logical and philosophical answers are worse than useless. So this is sort of a hint at like, well, look back and find, oh, the nature of mind. Yeah, it's like this. It's empty and clear. So no, we don't want to put any words on this. Even though if we had to put words, it would be something like that. The problem is, as soon as we put words on it, then it cuts off the direct experience. And we miss it. So this is nice. It's a non-conceptual. It fits into Zen. No logical or philosophical answers at the time of this practice. These reinforce your reliance on intellectual processes. This is not an intellectual practice. Awareness, not the intellect, sees the nature of mind. You cannot think your way to it. This is so important. Because we're so used to thinking our way to things, to figuring out things. So in this case, it's like, the same with koan practice, the little bit I understand about it. If you try to think about a koan to resolve it, that's like going astray. How do you do this, you know, kind of a specific practice, but without thinking your way into it? That's the challenge. Use the question, such as, what is mind, or bring me your mind, to direct attention to the mind or experience. Hold the question. Attention forms and begins to penetrate habituated structures of thought and experience. Reactive patterns are triggered. Thoughts, feelings, and confusion arise. I think just in the process, it brings up this stuff, or it could. Hold the question in the face of the reactive mechanisms. I think that's an interesting one. So like, this is ridiculous. It's some kind of mind game that, you know, I'm being tricked into like playing with the mind, trying to find the mind, like the thief riding its own horse. Like, what kind of like crazy thing is this? Why don't I just go back to sitting? And like, that's I think that would be one example of like all these reactive patterns and thoughts and confusion. Hold the question in the face of that. So it's ridiculous, but like, oh yeah, this underlying, I'm committed to asking this now. What is it actually, this? Forget it, don't do it. It's just a bunch of intellectual mumbo-jumbo. What is this? Who's saying that? Don't forget who's saying it. You'll never find him anyway. Who's saying that? Something like that, you know. You're keeping this, you're like penetrating through all of that like doubt and confusion. Looking and looking in a very direct way. Attention gradually penetrates these patterns and you're able to look more deeply and for longer periods. Seeing, you're saying Vipassana, seeing often arises as soon as the patterns are penetrated. So as soon as you like kind of cut through like this useless exercise, you kind of like kind of get through that to behind it, and then that seeing could be there. If it does not, then you need to cut the root of experience, which he's going to talk about in a minute. How do you know whether you've experienced this seeing? Generally, you will know. So if the mind is, this it? Is that it? Well, you'll know, but you should check your experience with a teacher. So cutting the root means turning attention to what is holding the question. So it's almost like another reversal, another turning the light around. Cutting the root means turning attention back to what is holding the question. who is this? Who is holding this question? In holding the question, you dissolve the clouding influence of the patterns, the other patterns that are kind of like distracting us from this. But the question still holds your attention, and reactive patterns are unable to function. Still, the pattern of subject-object fixation remains and prevents you from experiencing the nature of mind. Turn the attention back on what is looking, what is holding the question. It sounds like almost like a double turning the light around, what he's saying. Because the question, like, you know, bring me your mind, or what is mind, is already a kind of a turning back. But then he's saying this cutting the root is like then turning back on that question. Who's asking that, actually? Redirecting the attention breaks the subject-object fixation, and seeing can now arise. So it's just this little funny tool that's not, and the tool itself is not the point. It's just that it's this little thing that people discovered to break the subject-object fixation duality. At a certain point, the question and the looking dissolve into nothing. You feel as if the looking just fell to pieces. Now you see. Maybe that one who's looking falling to pieces and dissolving is the seeing. Rest right there. Rest in the seeing. Don't make any more effort. Initially, the seeing will last for only a short time, perhaps only a second or two. So this is another little hint to like, oh, I'm kind of like, I think I've been resting in this vipassana and nature of mind for like 10 minutes or so. Maybe highly unlikely at first. Like a second or two, right? So there, which kind of is pointing to, it's something kind of specific that's different than just being aware of the field of awareness. Because that actually you can stay with for minutes at a time. But this looking back where everything dissolves into non-duality, a second or two in the womb of light, and then almost like we're startled out of it, or the lab guy is like, quick, get a hold of it! And, you know, and some, you know, it could be quite subtle, but some like, or, you know, is this an already? It's gone. That's now the subject. Looking at an object and asking if it's it, right? Which is how the mind is working 24 hours a day. With it, you know, could be very subtle or very gross, but a subject looking at an object. So this second or two of dissolving into no reference points of subject and object, but bright, clear, totally relaxed, more relaxed than shamatha, and just free, like almost like the sense that like, what, anything can happen here, and it's like okay, and everything is almost like held in this space and emerging from it, this nature of mind. So return to holding the question and cutting the root. If you become confused by dullness or busyness, stop making efforts at holding the question and reestablish the base of attention, shamatha. Insight practice is best done for short periods of great intensity. And for the last, I think he's talking about like a 40-minute period, actually, where he says at the beginning, like a 45-minute period, and you spend the first 5 to 10 minutes resting with the breath, and then you spend another 10 minutes shifting to the wider field, and then you can start asking, if grounded in that, start asking who's experiencing, and then for the last 5 or 10 minutes just relax and rest, sit with your mind open and clear, let the energy and effort disperse, then go about your day. Makes it sound all cut and pat, so neat, right? But I think I really appreciate his way of like talking about the details of this. It could be a very simple practice, but he's kind of like bringing in some of his lab reports.
So that description of Vipassana.
Yeah, so that's Vipassana.
So how is that different from shamatha?
It's different because shamatha is the resting with this object, very subtle object, called the whole field of experience, very settled. But the difference is with shamatha, there's awareness is attending to an object called the present moment, or the field of experience. And I'd say, that's not really an object, is it? And I think part of the nice thing about that object is it's a very subtle object. The duality is getting like less and less in shamatha, but there's still a little bit. And vipassana is when you drop back into the through this like specific exercise of turning the light around, asking who, you drop back into the source of awareness, the thinker. Or the not thinker, you think of it, of what doesn't think. And the way you do it is using non-thinking. You don't use it thinking. And then in that dissolving, the duality, that last bit of subject-object duality dissolves. And then it's like a different experience, actually. So I think he says when you know, if you're wondering is this it, then it seems pretty much just like shamatha still, then maybe it's not. And yet it's like has a lot of the same qualities as shamatha. It's like totally relaxed, maybe slightly more, because there's just no holding anything. And maybe shamatha can be kind of like already. No, I don't know if it's always joyful, but peaceful. If we're really in calm abiding, it's very peaceful, and maybe a sense of like a subtle joy. And this is more like even more like boundless, joy, but very calm. And just a sense of like freedom. I think like there's no binding here at all. As you could say, if we say grasping, if grasping is suffering and shamatha, there's a little tiny bit of grasping still called subject-object duality is the basic grasping that emerges into huge grasping. And at this point, there's like no grasping. So it's like the end of suffering for 1 second.
Address that question. How about koan? How is koan different than go beyond shamatha to koan examining?
Yeah.
How is that different from vipassana?
I think we could look at koan work as a kind of vipassana. If it's done, you know, again, I haven't trained in that system where it's like in a sesshin format where you're sitting with the koan and the koan instructions as I read about it is like you try to carry it all day, like when you're sweeping, when you're doing the dishes, moo, or what is my original face until it's like you're so completely obsessed with it that like I even heard, and these are like, I think even American teachers talking like this, like when you go to sleep thinking about it, or holding that, and you wake up, and your first thought when you wake up, what's my original face? And then all day, and so in a way it's this intensive questioning insight, less and less conceptual, until I think the same effect, it dissolves. Like, what is my original face? Like, the ridiculousness of that question dissolves into your original face, and that's it. But I think, you know, outside of like a kind of sesshin kind of setting where it's like all, and you're focusing on it all day, then it's, and you're kind of thinking about the koan, that's maybe not vipassana, strictly speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
this one time, sort of magically, long time ago, 40 years ago, I was traveling in a Japanese monk that I didn't know, not a monk, a priest, and we were in a hostel or something, you know, and we just got talking, and he said, your koan is, what was your original purpose before you were born? That's what I want you to do. I said, okay, you know, I mean, I wasn't really a Zen student or anything, but he was giving me a gift. I think he was mm-hmm. very kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that, that is, I worked with that for quite a while
mm-hmm.
and decided that that was an impossible, that, you know, either I'd have to get comfortable with the impossibility of it or I could keep going on forever. But there was another alternative. And that's something that we've actually talked about a little bit, and that is that I could have a story or a myth about it that might be useful to me. And what occurred to me was, well, in the absolute, there's no answer I can ever, I have no idea. It's the same thing as asking what infinity is about, you know, where I come from or my or the purpose. That's asking what God's doing, is, you know, that's getting into all that. And so I can't, but I came up with the idea of, but if I want to have a story, which I don't object to, if it's not a nasty story, I could have one that says, well, this is just a supposition, so I won't say it's the truth, but my story will be that we somehow arrive here with a purpose to learn through suffering to let go, that this life somehow in this setting, that it turns out this setting isn't really an ongoing thing. It's a constant setting that always will be causing suffering and will always be creating the conditions for having to let go. You know, so this is not my idea of the truth. But I'm just asking, I'm just saying. But
it's not your idea of the truth?
No, it's not my idea of the truth. It's my idea of a story.
Well, it's what an idea is anyway, right? So you could say, if I have an idea of the truth,
right,
this would be a good way to express that as an idea. I think it's a good idea.
Well, I'm saying, even if you understand that you haven't grasped anything absolute or anything you mm-hmm. would call the truth, if it seems like, well, that could be, mm-hmm. and it kind of works for me, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, since I really do want to work on letting go.
I like it. I like that story. Personally, I like it a lot, that our purpose here is to, in this life, is to learn how to let go. I love that story.
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, and you don't attach to it as if, I mean, if you're pressed, you're going to say, I don't, you know.
Yeah. And we have, and it's fine to have stories. In fact, it's more than fine. We live in the world of stories. We have to have stories. If there's no life if we don't have stories.
Right.
So, and then as far as stories go, we can hold, some are more fun than others, and that one's super fun. I love it.
Well, that's why I think we keep talking about. We talk about the zip lines. Get this, you know, I'm not.
Well, that's, but to know that that's just a story.
Yes.
Yeah, that is a story. And when you said something earlier, when you said the impossibility. Well, this is like impossibility. I can just like, you know, or I can,
or
you know.
Impossible.
But I think something when you said impossibility, I thought, yeah, that's how these koans, they're all about impossibility.
Yeah, they are.
Actually, that's what they're kind of for. And so, well, we can't just live in impossibility. So then when we're in the story land, which is like most of the time, then stories like, my purpose in this story land is to let go of stories. That's a great story, right?
Life and death.
Yeah, life, everything, everything.
Salvation.
We're here to learn how to do that is great. It's a test. It's an experiment.
I mean, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
That could be. I mean, but...
Well, how could it not be?
Yeah.
I mean, here it is.
I mean,
it's what we make it, right?
Because that, if
I mean, it's not like somebody created the purpose for us. It's just like, here we are. That's our purpose. It's not like some... There's anyway. So cutting the root, he says just a little bit more, very similar, but this is just a little more detail. So cutting the root again is like you're asking the question, who is this? And then you ask, who's asking the question? Who's holding the question? So it's like you keep going back. There's another image that I've has come up when practicing with this turning the light around. The sesshin sort of came up as like kind of that stepping back, learning the stepping back, step back a little and like, ah, yeah, and like, nope. But then it's a little bit like the lab guy taking notes on the other lab guy. But this is like the one who's aware, but who's aware of that, but who's aware of that, stepping back until like, until almost like you see the silliness of like layers of stepping back, and you just like let go of the whole thing, and that's kind of it. So cutting the root is, I think he said, was looking now into who's holding the question. So now pose the question, who is experiencing this? And he's saying, first he's saying, now who's experiencing this? This. I'm going to do it right now. Who's experiencing this? He says, like, keep the experience, the color and the shape of the book, you know, or whatever you're looking at. This is, you know, whatever you're seeing. And but as much direct perception as you can, color field, who's experiencing this? And the seeing in attention. So keep the experience, the color and shape of books and floors and stuff, and seeing in attention, and look at what is experiencing it. So here I'm looking at this stuff, and if we're looking at it really directly and calmly and not with no elaboration, that's shamatha. And then to look back, who's looking at this? It shifts into vipassana. And if you start thinking or wondering about what experience is, you've fallen out of attention. So if you think or wonder, yeah, who is it actually? If there's any intellectualization about it, you lose it. Relax, go back to the pure experience and ask again, what is experiencing this? At some point, you experience a strange shift. The usual framework of subject-object perception collapses for a moment. You see that which arises as experience is your mind. You're clear, awake, and present, and perhaps a little awed and puzzled. The shift is to a different seeing in which appearances, that is, what arises in experience, and mind, that is, experiencing itself, are not separate. So the experiencer and the experienced are not separate. That's non-duality. Yes?
I've been trying this since you talked about it the first day I was here, and almost I get the image, the experience for me is like I'm building this house of cards, that is the Vipassana house of cards, and I got it.
Maybe shamatha house of cards. Yeah, shamatha house of cards. Yep.
This house of cards.
Yep.
And I got it getting really tall, and I'm about to put that last piece on it, and it's like bam, and it knocks it over, and just it frustrates me. And I get knocked out of the whole shaman.
Mm-hmm. That's just what he described, right?
Yeah, that's why I started laughing.
Yeah.
I just got to open my eyes and just
got me. Yeah.
One and start over and start putting.
I like that image. That I have the same experience like that. Yeah, you're, you know, because the shamatha card house is so fragile, right? It's like the least thought will blow it over. So it's like you're so careful, and then you're generating a kind of a thought, very trying to keep it very, very simple, but this asking is a kind of disturbing thing you're like, okay, we'll just settle, and why not just stay? And it's so peaceful and calm and nice, and like, you know, one of the teachers has said, shamatha will relieve If you're really like resting and calm abiding, will relieve like 70 to 80% of your suffering. It's a percentage. The majority of your problems are relieved. So like, I can now take a, now I'm gambling. Yeah. It's like, do I want the last 30% of the last bit of my problems to dissolve, or am I satisfied with this?
Yeah. Satisfied.
Especially if going for the 30 is going to wreck the whole.
That's right. That's right. That last 30% is a gamble. You might knock down the house. So this is part of the lab thing, and why somebody may mention this. It's like a courageous thing. It's like a courageous act to like, okay, I really want to get to the bottom of this. I've been sitting here long enough. And maybe what it takes is like sitting at 70% for a while. If we just finally get to 70% calm abiding, finally, just a little calm abiding, well, let's not mess with that. But if we're kind of like getting more playful with calm abiding, and it's like, okay, then we can try this other bit. And, you know, of course, that brings up all the ideas about gaining idea and stuff. Like, come on, 100%. But I think there can be the mind at this point, almost like the natural curiosity of the mind. It's part of what shamatha traditionally has said. It's this flexible mind. It's like calm abiding is defined, that kind of state of calm abiding, after you've been practicing calm abiding, the result is called calm abiding, according to like the sutra. Shamatha is really the result of the training towards shamatha. And the definition of shamatha is like the mental and physical pliancy that comes from that practice of letting go and letting go and letting go. And that mental and physical pliancy is like a readiness. It's kind of like I feel more buoyant and alert and clear and ready and flexible. And like, I don't mind gambling. I don't mind if the house falls now. I'm trying another 30%. It's kind of like maybe part of the flexibility, the pliancy. And so what? It falls down, we build it again. But I think that's a common thing. And where the house collapse is, in my experience, is if this questioning becomes too conceptual, basically. Which we're so used to asking, like, who is this? If we ask it like, we usually ask, well, who is this? And like, let's see now, who is this? That's too conceptual. It's got to be really direct, like, almost like, maybe who is this, what, it has that problem. So what if we just say like the word like, back, or fall, or drop, maybe like that. It doesn't have, if we just say drop, that's
you're
what...
cutting away any conceptual...
Yeah, you're already really, you're letting go of a lot, and but you can sense, it's kind of nice too to get the sense, the little lab tech guy is watching here, like, is in this settled shamatha with this field of awareness, is there a little duality? And I've been doing that to check it out. I'm like, yeah. I mean, partly the guy asking creates a little bit more. But even before, you know, if he just takes a quick look, yeah, I feel like there's me, some sense of me, the ego sense is very, almost non-existent at this point already. We're pretty settled, but a little bit of what you might call me, or just the observer. There's a little sense of the observer observing the field of awareness a little bit, I feel like. And then we might just say, okay, drop. And that's pretty non-conceptual. And that sense of falling back into the observer. I think this image of back, even though the source of mind has no location, we know that already, and we've been playing with it. It's the heart, it's the whole body. No, it's no location. But to say back, I just find it's a skillful means. It's not really true that it's back there, but it's just that our attention is so forward directed, especially if we're looking at the visual field. So that just to say back points the attention more towards like the source of the attention. So drop back, that's like a looking back, but without, with virtually no conceptuality. And that's where I think it just becomes, maybe it's a little different creative way that each person might find to do this.
That's good. Is that back with no direction?
That was...
Is that back with no direction?
That's maybe two directional still. That sense, I have a feeling of like the backward step. I mean, these are just ways of talking about it. So just last little piece here, and he says more, but the last piece to share here. When you look back and dissolve into this spacious, bright, and empty, referenceless, not a state actually, but like, we can't say what it is, right? It's seeing, and it rests in the seeing. At first, it will last for only a moment, but when it fades, don't try to recover it. Instead, repeat the whole process. Look at the object, go through all the labels until the experience of the object arises as pure experience. Back to that, you know, okay, just the field of awareness with no naming or anything. Then, again, cut the root by asking, what is experiencing this? And again, rest in the seeing. When your seeing shifts, rest in seeing. Don't do anything more. If you keep asking questions at this point, you spin meaninglessly in confusion like a dog chasing its own tail. Even to ask like, okay, is this seeing, or what do I do now, or any of that, you know. Just rest in it. Gradually, you will rest for longer periods in seeing, shattering the illusion that subject and object are independent and separate. Recall the instruction to regard everything as a dream. Now, perhaps, the instruction makes more sense. Appearances arise in experience. What arises in experience is not separate from what experiences, which we call your mind, just as in a dream, what arises in the dream is not separate from the mind that's dreaming. And then, go about your day as in a dream. And then we forget that, so it's like, no, it's really like, this is really like, this is not a dream, this is like a major problem and I have to resolve it and work it out, and it's like, and then we like go back to zazen. And so I think this dream analogy, I think, is just a wonderful way of talking about this, the union of the conventional and ultimate, because the world is vividly apparent. It's like we live in this world, everything matters, every detail of what we do, the precepts, the forms, our relationships.
Choice, responsibility,
all the stuff we have to, you know, work out is like, yeah, we take it seriously, we're totally involved in it. And if we can remember this perspective, that from the seeing, resting in the seeing, can become more and more like, remind us that, well, it's, you know, it really is actually like a dream. And we get so involved in it that we're like, we start taking it too seriously.
I do like the analogy of being an instrument. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace, or a musician saying, let me be played by inspiration, by the mystery, by whatever, but let me get out of the way.
Yeah, that's a little bit like, like me, that the me that's the instrument. It's like this body and mind is a very important thing in this dream world for this body, you know, almost like this, like Buddha, this boundless, formless expanse of Buddha nature is like congeals or like manifests, is what we usually say. Even Dogen says like manifests as like this body and mind. So, you know, it's so then this body and mind is like the instrument of Buddha nature, this formless Buddha nature. And here it is, like that movie Avatar. Yeah, see that movie Avatar?
Oh, yeah.
It's like there's some, you know, the person's in a, I forget how it worked exactly, right? But they're like, their mind is somewhere else in a way. You know, this is just, the metaphor breaks down, but like, their mind is like on a bed plugged into something, I think. And they're in this like amazing creature, right? In this like jungle world. Have this dragon kind of creature, like that, right? And they say that's what an avatar is Sanskrit, right? For like an incarnation, or like it literally means to descend into something. It's like when like God descends into a human body, they call it like a saint or an avatar, right? So the movie is playing with that, right? It's like your mind is like manifest as this creature, and it really feels, it looks down like it's like I'm the creature. Here's my scaly hands. Here's my eyes, and I can fly. And but it's actually just a manifestation. It's like a dream, yeah. So we could see it like that. That the body and mind is the instrument of Buddha nature. And we, in this dream world, that this is the main thing we use, is body, mind.
Well, in the job, which I think we do, we talk about in this practice, is to empty that instrument like a hollow reed, you know, so that it can be spontaneous, it can be played, you know, I mean, that's
yeah.
The spontaneity.
Yeah.
It's being empty enough.
Yeah.
It's not you anymore.
Mm-hmm. Know? Yeah, yeah.
It's just
Buddha nature coming
Buddha
through.
Nature popping up.
Mm-hmm.
It's incidentally is one of the most hilarious. Whatever else I can say about this apparent Buddha nature is it's got a hell of a sense of humor.
Yeah, like great ancestor Lin Ji said, there's a true person of no position, no rank, and no reference points. Moving in and out through the portals of your face. If you haven't seen him, look, and back. That's where you're going to find him. And then a monk comes forward and says, "This true person of no position, what kind of a fellow is he?" And Lin Ji and his usual style, grabs him by the collar, pulls him up close and says, speak! You know, like, let this Buddha nature, like, come through you unobstructed. Speak now. Don't hesitate.
Right.
Don't think about it. Speak! And the monk's like, get me out of here! And then he kind of pushes him away and says, the true person of no rank, like a pile of dried crap. But you could say, well, maybe like, you know, it's all true expression, and that's just the way Lindy talked, right? But you could say, this is the true person of no rank. Just like, you know, couldn't let him come through the portals of his face when he was under great pressure. So, you know, some of those then ancestors would like, you know, push people to the edge, and you know, we have a more gentle style. That's Lin Ji of the Rinzai school. So they took that on. They took on his style. So if somebody moves in the Zendo, don't move. yell across the zendo. You could say maybe same thing, and the person would say, "Oh, did I do that? Shouldn't I have done that?" And like, who's thinking that? Who moved, and who's thinking they shouldn't move? And like, who are they yelling at? But it's kind of obnoxious. It's my like time sense is that it's late, and it is. Yeah, time is a manifestation of this empty Buddha nature that has no time. But that's the world. Since we live in this world of apparent time, and this dream construction has like hours and minutes and stuff, so we play the game and have lunch and stuff. But just before we do, just to close with a poem. It's actually not Hongzhi here. It's Shirto. And this is actually my, like, you know, intellectual, conceptual research mind, you know, scanning through the Chinese canon and stuff, discovered, I'm pretty sure this is true, that this is the first place in the Fortunate Aeon, which is Shakyamuni Buddha's kalpa that we live in now, where the term Ekko Hensho appeared. Ekko Hensho, turning the light around and shining back. Looks like in the thousands of texts that you can digitally search, that this is chronologically the first time Shirto, our ancestor, Sekito Kisen, who wrote The Merging of Difference and Unity, coined the term. And then it's interesting because it's used all through the Golden Age. Linji uses it. Guishan, Yangshan, Dogen. 700 to 790. And this is, you probably heard this before, Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. That's where turning the light around first. And I feel like the whole poem is kind of about that, if we hear it in that way. And the grass hut, sometimes we wonder, what is the grass? There's a grass hut with a person in it, in this poem. And I don't know the grass hut, but I'm just kind of seeing it as, now I'm seeing it as the body, or even like the avatar body and mind experience of like this person. Or this body and mind experience that's a manifestation of Buddha nature, and Buddha nature is like the person that lives in the hut. So if you listen to it that way, see if it seems in accord. This is the hut of this body and mind sitting zazen, and the person in it is boundless, unlocatable. Nature of mind. I've built the grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds of all my conceptual thoughts. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, an old man illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle, Bodhisattva, trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn around the light and shine it back, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction. Bind together grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Thank you for your great efforts and diligent practice, this Sesshin. And whether you know it or not, I say you've accumulated boundless heaps of merit. And on behalf of all of you, because I think you would agree with me, that let's dedicate all of this merit to all living beings everywhere, all those particularly suffering and that don't have a chance to spend such a useless week looking back at the source. And may Buddha nature do its work through every living being everywhere, each in their own unique way. And the Buddha's birth in this world continue to express itself endlessly. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.